Well, I'm really pumped to be here with Dr. Joseph Mercola today. Joe, thank you for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here.
Yeah, last time we interviewed was maybe about a year ago, and we're on the other side of the United States now. We're in California.
Right.
And I'm really excited to get your perspective on some new theories and some new research you've been doing on cancer. So let's just begin with that. Share with us what you've been learning lately.
Well, I've never previously been comfortable with treating cancer patients in my clinical career because I never really understood the key approaches one needed to not only prevent it, but treat it, at least from a metabolic perspective, because there's many variables that contribute to cancer. But thanks to Dr. Otto Warburg, who was an MD, PhD, brilliant biochemist of the 20th century, and his disciples since then, primarily Thomas Seyfried and a variety of others, they and a book I read, because I walk a lot, hours a day, and I read 150 books this year. And the most important one I read was The Tripping Over the Truth by Travis Christofferson, which really described this whole process of, and summarized very eloquently the material that I'd previously known, but just made it really profoundly clear. And that, in combination with my mentoring by Ron Rosedale, who taught me the importance of insulin and protein limitation to a very specific level, really opened up my eyes. I had an epiphany. The lights went off, and I clearly understood for the first time how you can treat most cancers metabolically and treat it very effectively. And it's tragic because most clinicians aren't aware of this, and 1,600 people are dying every single day in the United States alone, 20,000 in the world every day. So I'm really excited about it and hope to have a book out in 2017 that describes the simple protocols. It's like 10,000 puzzle pieces and trying to put it all together and kind of refine it as you go along. So I'm connecting with some world-class clinicians and molecular biologists and really the top experts in the world on this, and one nutritionist that worked for Dr. Seyfried, who's treated over 400 cancer patients, probably the expert in the world at this point. So it's an exciting process.
Yeah, it sounds exciting. Now, when you say you're treating or learning to treat cancer metabolically, what does that mean?
Well, the most clinicians that treat cancer and physicians believe that cancer is a nuclear genetic disease, that turns out not to be true, but nevertheless, that's what most clinicians believe. And Dr. Seyfried compiled a large amount of research that shows why it's not true. But essentially, to summarize it pretty briefly, is that the mitochondria, which are the energy organelles in our body that create our energy, the vast majority of it, like close to 90%, when they become damaged and dysfunctional, they send signals that actually triggers the damage in the nucleus. So the nuclear genetic damage is actually downstream side effect from the more foundational primary cause, which is damage to the mitochondria. And so the whole focus really needs to be on understanding how to engage the body into two really important, profound metabolic processes. One is something called autophagy, or in the mitochondria's case, mitophagy. And that is essentially recycling of cellular parts. When it becomes damaged and injured, you've got to get rid of it. You've got to take the garbage out. And unfortunately, due to a variety of challenges, that process becomes impaired, inhibited, or really blocked significantly in most people. And that's what contributes to cancer. I mean, it's an impairment in autophagy. And the other one is the converse of that, which is biogenesis or regeneration of the mitochondria, mitochondrial biogenesis. So if you can upregulate those two metabolic pathways, repair and regenerate and remove the damaged mitochondria, then you can help people recover from not only cancer, which is my primary passion because there's such an urgent need. People are dying every day. Mm-hmm. But also heart disease, the number one killer of Americans, neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, obesity, diabetes, seizures. It's pretty much about 75-80% of the diseases, the population that has some type of or form of this disease.
Mm. So that's interesting, though. So you talk about autophagy.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I've read the word a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought it's autophagy because I've never heard anybody say it.
Yeah, if you look at it, that's the way it looks like
it's
pronounced.
But autophagy.
But
so
it's autophagy. Yeah.
It's a problem that may be detoxification oriented. Then with that step, that two phases,
well,
right?
exposure to toxins certainly can contribute to mitochondrial damage.
Okay.
No question about it. But that's an excellent question because it leads me to what do I believe, and maybe I'm confused seriously, but I doubt it. But I believe the primary reason that most mitochondria become damaged is that we are providing them with the wrong fuel. 95% of the fuel in our body is fat. 5% is carbohydrates. So it makes sense that metabolically we're designed to burn fat as our primary fuel.
Right.
Problem is, most people are using carbohydrates and eating them on a regular basis, which just essentially, there's a process that occurs within the mitochondria where it consumes oxygen, and typically that oxygen is converted to water. And if you have the ideal fuel, which is not carbohydrate, but if you have the ideal fuel, the number of damaging side effects, essentially dirty fuel, you know, the pollutants, right, so to speak, would be these reactive oxygen species.
Okay.
And these reactive oxygen species, which usually occur in the mitochondria themselves, are very damaging. They can damage enormous amounts of tissues, the cellular membranes, proteins, but most importantly, the mitochondria, they damage the mitochondrial DNA, which then subsequently messes up the signaling to the nucleus and causes these profound plethora of complicating metabolic problems. So when you have carbohydrate, you just generate excess free radicals, essentially. Okay. And if you can shift the body over towards eating more fat, and specific type of fat, not just any fat,
regular fat,
you know, you're gonna cause more damage, which is one of the reasons why we've had a problem for the last 100 years. We've been eating the wrong type of fat for the most part. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but most people. So if you get the body to convert over to eating the right fat and produce ketones that as a primary fuel, then that will burn much cleaner, far cleaner, generate these far less reactive oxygen species, mm-hmm, that causes less free radicals, which keeps the mitochondria healthy. And it also, the same process, when you do that, the artifacts is that you optimize these diverse but incredibly important metabolic pathways, like insulin and IGF-1 and AMPK and mTOR and PGC1 alpha and probably a dozen others that interrelate. But when they're optimized, leptin, you know, then like every metabolic pathway in your body just nearly is optimized, and you are profoundly healthy. And one of the most important conditions that I said maybe 80% of the population has been suffers from the other ones I mentioned. Mm-hmm. But 100%, every single person suffers from this one. You know what that one is?
Mm-mm.
Aging.
Ah, okay.
We're all aging. Okay. And there's a number of experts and researchers who believe that aging is a disease, you know, and that if we can optimize these things, now, well, the most perfect diet in the world will not let us live forever, no question. Right. It's going to get us to maybe easily to 110. And if you're really good with some other variables, it may be a 120. But at least it'll set the stage for where you can apply these other advances in technology, stem cells, nanobots, a whole variety of other intriguing technological advancements that are emerging that will allow us to extend lifespans considerably.
Yeah.
How far, we don't know, but it would be considerable extension.
Cool. You mentioned healthy fats.
Yes.
So I used to be a competitive bodybuilder, and it's interesting that we avoided fats like the plague back in the early 90s. The bodybuilding diet was, mm-hmm, all carbohydrates, all protein, no fat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It was when the fat-free cheeses became popular and the fat-free everythings, and they basically compensated by adding more sugar. Right? But that was what was popular then. But then the Atkins diet became popular, mm-hmm, in the middle 90s. And a lot of the guys that I was competing with switched over to try to go ketogenic. The problem was they were eating bacon and peanut butter, mm-hmm, and all this other kind of stuff that we wouldn't really look at as healthy fats. So when you say the ketogenic or the going to ketosis needs healthy fats, can you name some
fats?
Well,
I don't like to refer to it as ketosis or ketogenic diet. I call it a healthy fat diet.
Yeah,
but
so what are they?
Don't feel bad, because I made the same mistake.
Okay.
And I think most of us did. If you grew up, you know, if you're over 50, you probably were exposed to this low-fat myth, there was a good reason why it was propagated by Ansel Keys in the 50s, because in the early 1900s, there was this shift towards industrialization and processing of fats, which essentially allowed us to have refined vegetable oils, which is, and for the most part, high in omega-6 fats, and we were never designed to eat. 1900, we ate like less than a pound a year. 2000, we're eating 75 pounds a year. That transition probably resulted in enormous amounts of disease and pathology and really the epidemic in heart disease we see prior to the 50s. So that's what Ansel Keys jumped on, and he was partially correct, because it was a fat issue, but it wasn't what he thought. Low fat wasn't the answer, it was just eating the right fat. He got it totally mixed up.
Okay.
So that is the key, is to eat the right fats. So what's the right fats? We're looking at probably one of the simplest, singlest, best ones is avocados, okay? Avocados are incredible. They're full of monounsaturated fats, typically oleic acid, I believe. And the keys are a little bit pricey. So if you live in a subtropical environment, you can grow them yourself. I got four avocado trees, so it's ideal. But most of us don't, and we have to go to the store. So they're kind of pricey, so what you do is you wait for a sale. And you buy like 20 or 30 of them, 50, 60. But you only have to be rock hard green. So then you put them in the fridge, and they last for up to 3 weeks. And then you take them out 2 or 3 days before you're going to use them, depending on the temperature. Yeah. You know. And then you've got them ready to serve. But you can have 2-3 avocados a day. I typically have two. That's my range, 2 or 3 a day, at least two. And it's enormously, and if you're a smaller person, that's going to be a significant portion of your calorie
intake. It's very filling.
Incredibly filling, high in potassium, and most of us are way too low in potassium, and a lot of other important micronutrients. But it's one of the healthiest fats you can get, and it's a live, living food. So that's the best. You want to eat real food, and avocado is certainly an example of that. Then other ones would be butter, coconut oil would be another one, but avocado is still better. And then you can go to nuts. Some of the, not all nuts, and you can't go overboard on these, but the two healthiest would be macadamias and pecans. Because they're really high in fat, low in protein. And you also mentioned when you were in the bodybuilding, and I think today, still many bodybuilders will have large amounts of protein.
Huge amounts of protein.
Yeah, and you know, that's your community. It's certainly not mine. In retrospect, if I could rewind my life, I would have preferred to, instead of engage in the endurance long distance running strategies I did, to engage in bodybuilding, but I didn't. I made that mistake. But and maybe it was better because I wouldn't have had the high protein. And so what type of levels of protein are bodybuilders typically doing?
Oh, I mean, I know guys that are doing 30 to 50 grams 7-8 times a day.
So 50 times 8 would be 400 grams,
yeah.
Up to 400 grams a
yeah.
day. Okay, well, they are taking, you know, 5-6 times more than they need. Mm. Now, how much protein do you need? It's a simple metabolic calculation. You can rewind this if you... want to listen to it again, but it's a gram per kilogram of lean body mass. So if you're 10% body fat, which is pretty low, then it would be 90% of your weight, and then you take, and you have to divide your weight by in pounds by 2.2 to get kilograms, or just about a half a gram per pound, if you just want to simplify it, of lean body mass. So why do you want to limit protein? This is what Dr. Rosedale taught me, and he was really one of the first healthcare professionals to understand this, because he was an avid reader of the, or still is, of the molecular biology literature, and understood that there's this profoundly important and ancient biochemical pathway called mTOR, and that's not many people know about it, but it's short for mammalian target of rapamycin. Rapamycin is an anti-cancer drug, and which is how this was discovered, which was discovered way after I finished medical school. So, I mean, you don't feel bad if you don't know about this, because it's just, you know, it's a recent discovery. And as a result of that, they learned that when you, the bodybuilders are taking that protein because it works. When you take excess protein, mTOR signaling pathway is sensitive to nutrients, specifically amino acids. So when you take a lot of amino acids, you will activate mTOR to the max. Mm. What does mTOR do? It builds tissue, it builds muscle. But guess what cancer does? It's building tissue
Same
too.
Thing.
So you're activating cancer. So you want, the key is to get low cancer to be healthy. I mean, not locally, low mTOR levels, inhibit the mTOR. Not necessarily all the time, but most of the time, because you definitely want to build muscle. There's no question. So you can have higher levels of protein, especially the branched chain amino acids, which will stimulate mTOR really profoundly, but only around strength training. If you're strength training twice a week, then you only take it twice a week.
Okay.
Not 4 times, 8 times a day. You know, that's just beyond crazy. So when you understand that and you limit the non-fiber carbs, and a non-fiber carb is you take your total carbs, subtract your fiber, and then you have non-fiber carbs, and that's really the sugars. Even in avocados or kale, there's still non-fiber carbs. There's sugar in there. Not much, but a little bit. And if you're eating the healthy foods, it's almost a non-issue because you're going to be under 50 grams. It's only when you start going to processed foods that you have to be concerned about this. So if you're under 50 grams of non-fiber carbs a day, limit your protein to 1 gram per kilogram of lean body mass.
Okay.
75% of the rest of your calories are healthy fats that we talked about. then you have given yourself really the ideal body or fuel that's not dirty, that's clean fuel, that will generate minimal reactive oxygen species, that will really accelerate your body's ability to inhibit the formation of cancer or treat it if you have it. Yeah. And work synergistically with whatever type of treatment intervention you choose, whether it be conventional, like with chemo, or some unusual alternative approach, it will work synergistically. Okay. So, I mean, to me, it's the foundation. It really is the foundation. You know, like, you know, in when you were weight training, I mean, it wasn't how much you lifted. It was really, you had to have the right fuel.
Yeah.
If the wrong fuel, when you could, your workout regimen, it was irrelevant.
Yep.
It's the same thing. All these other therapies will tend to fail or not work as optimally if you don't have the diet right. So that is the foundation theory. That's why I'm so passionate about helping people understand it and apply this so that they don't have to die prematurely from cancer.
So, Dr. McCullough, you know, one of the important things that I think you just shared is the fact that we don't have to actually eliminate all carbs, because I know people that are trying to get into this ketosis and they're eating meat, butter, cheese.
Sure.
And they're like, I can't do any carbs because it'll throw me out of ketosis. So the reality is there's a lot of carbs. It's about the net carbs. So the carbs that are vegetables with heavy fiber, those are good, right? Yeah. We shouldn't stop eating those.
No, it's crazy. They are really important to stay healthy. You need carbohydrates. You have to have carbohydrates. So the confusion is, and there's a common confusion to think that the type of diet I'm suggesting or promoting is an Atkins. It's not. And it could be, and it's the furthest thing from Atkins. The primary one was the one we just mentioned. It's a limitation of the protein. If you go over that, you're going to run into severe problems. So, I mean, you could theoretically go 90% fat and 10% protein, but that's not healthy because you need carbs. And let's look at the cow. The cow, you would think, is eating a high carbohydrate diet.
Grass.
Right? It's just grass. But essentially, that's almost all fiber. It's almost 100% fiber. Now, you call it net carbs. I call it the term non-fiber carbs.
Okay.
Those are the ones that are dangerous. They're the ones that are glucose and the sugars. That's in normal foods, and you can have some. You just don't want to have a lot. So you can have, like the cow eats 100% grass diet, but it really, what happens is when the cow eats, the grass goes down the intestine, gets digested by the bacteria there, converts it to short-chain fatty acids, butyrate, propionic, and acetate. And those go to the liver, and the liver converts it to ketones. And ketones are water-soluble fats, very short, very short. They go directly into the mitochondria. They don't need a carrier like L-carnitine, and they burn very, very efficiently. So you can make them from fat. It's harder to do, but it's much better to have the carbohydrates, the fiber carbohydrates. And I think you should eat about, for every gram of non-fiber carbs, you should have like 2 grams of fiber. Because these fibers are really important, and they nourish the intestinal lining and the health, and they prevent colon cancer and leaky gut, and they also are fuel for your beneficial bacteria, and they suppress the pathogenic disease-causing bacteria, fungi, and the viruses. So it's essential to have healthy carbohydrates, and that's a lot of vegetables. And by volume, they're not calorie-dense, so you know, my salad is typically a bowl that's like maybe as big or twice as big as my head every day. You know, and there's not much calories in there until I put my protein in and my fat.
Yeah.
But I mean, it'd probably be 100, 150 calories. I mean, if you just count the vegetables.
A lot of sprouts?
Oh, yeah. I think live raw food is important, and I make my own sprouts and every day. I pretty much have them. I even travel with them because they're easy to do, and they're inexpensive. If you buy them at the grocery store, you're going to pay $30 a pound. You make them yourself, you're paying like 20 cents a pound.
Yeah.
So, and it's nice to see. It's good for the kids. You know, you kind of see them grow and appreciate the miracle of life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So those are really the keys then with this type of an approach to cancer is limiting the protein,
mm-hmm.
high quality fats, mm-hmm. and don't get rid of carbohydrates. Eat the quality carbohydrates with the natural fibers.
Yes.
That gets you down to your non-fiber carbohydrates being very small.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. That's the key.
You got to have vegetables, healthy vegetables. You know, ideally organic, because if it's not organic, it's likely sprayed with Roundup or some other potent toxic derivative.
Which is now, is it a known carcinogen or a probable carcinogen?
Well, in 2015, the World Health Organization classified it as a class 2A carcinogen.
Okay.
So it's definitely a carcinogen. No, it's been, that's what the experts say. So
and we spray it on the food?
Well, not that much, only 10 billion tons. Or 10 million tons. 10 million tons.
Okay. So just 10 million tons.
Yeah.
Wow.
Collectively on the U.S. soil since it's been introduced. That's a lot. That's a lot of glyphosate. Mm. That's, and it, we say glyphosate, or Roundup is actually more accurate because it's with the surfactant. The surfactant makes it about 1,000 times more toxic because it just works synergistically with the glyphosate in the...
Oh, really? So yeah. What we're talking about is even more carcinogenic than what's been glyphosate. Declared as a
right,
carcinogen.
Right, because Roundup is much, much worse.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's truly amazing. And we think that's okay.
Well, confused and uninformed people may think it's okay, but if you've studied this area carefully, you'll realize that it's not.
Yeah, we don't think it's okay, right. But as a general rule still, sure. The country thinks that's,
yeah, the,
that's
okay. Yeah, the typical consumer is not aware of this.
Right. Right. Yeah. Let's talk about awareness in another area, Dr.
Sure.
McCullough. Vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
So when 16 years ago, when my eldest daughter was born, we were beginning to learn about the dangers of vaccines, the possible mm-hmm. harm. We went to the pediatrician, and we voiced our concerns, and the pediatrician looked my wife in the face and said, if you don't vaccinate your child, you're not welcome here. And so based on pressure from the pediatrician, we vaccinated her. And then she showed some symptoms of autism, mm-hmm. Not full autistic, but she regressed. She stopped talking, she stopped walking right after the vaccine. Mm-hmm. Now, we learned shortly after that about the dangers of vaccines and began to do research, and we have not vaccinated our two youngest children. But that was a situation with us that the pressure that we got, the lack of education that we had, we could have potentially harmed our child for life.
Mm-hmm.
But we all believe that vaccines are safe and effective.
Well,
are they?
It's a commonly held belief because they've been around for so long. I mean, they were initially done to eliminate smallpox, and that was, of course, a while ago, well over 100 years ago. Maybe 150, I can't remember specifically. But the belief is that that use of that vaccine was able to eliminate and eradicate that disease from the planet when it really wasn't. If you carefully study this, and we don't have enough time to go into the details, but there are books that discuss this very well and go into the historical epidemics because there's issues with hygiene and sanitation. And Suzanne Humphreys, who's a nephrologist, MD, has written a book on this. I think it's called Dissolving Illusions, if I'm not mistaken. That is really excellent.
I'll be interviewing her in 2 months.
Yeah, she's just a magnificent woman and really sacrificed her own career to spread this message because she didn't want to. I mean, she has integrity and really had a conscience and didn't want to expose her sickest patients to these vaccines because she was seeing the harm and damage. She was anecdotally observing this, and she was required by hospital policy to do that. She said, why? And the frequent explanation was smallpox vaccine. So she started to research it, and she basically quit her job and living on a pauper's salary now compared to what she was making, and just to spread this information and message. Mm-hmm. So there's some... If you carefully examine it, but it's really a challenge because this is the most grounded, firmly entrenched belief in preventive medicine and health and conventional medicine, that the vaccine are crucial to be healthy. And, and in my belief, it's nothing could be further from the truth. It's your own immune system by implementing some of the dietary strategies we talked about and addressing some other factors and variables that are important. That you stay healthy. That optimizes your immune system. It's your immune system that does the damage, not these vaccines. Mm-hmm. Because it's okay. Our bodies were designed and created to develop an immune response. And when they're healthy, they create it. So when you're exposed to an infectious agent, it's going to form the protective antibodies. Not only for a short term like you do with vaccines, but it's going to do it virtually indefinitely, and in most cases, lifelong. You have lifelong permanent immunity when you have a healthy immune system and you're exposed to an infectious agent. Mm. That's the ideal. You know, now they're doing these vaccines and it's like, oh, maybe every 10 years, maybe every 5 years. You know, there are third, fourth boosters of DPT now. That it's going to be 10 boosters. You're going to have to get it every year.
Yeah.
It's just insane because it's not the way the body was designed to create an immune response.
Mm.
When you do it artificially, it's almost universally going to be less than ideal.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a good takeaway, is that that's not the way that we were designed to gain immunity.
Clearly wasn't.
So in light of that fact, last question, Dr. Mercola. Yeah. We're sitting in a hotel in California.
Mm-hmm.
California last year passed a bill that requires children to be vaccinated before they go to school.
Well, I believe, I don't know, certainly correct me if I'm mistaken, but I believe that requirement existed. What they did with that bill is they eliminated the philosophical exemption.
You're absolutely right. They eliminated the exemptions to the rules.
So that you could, which was great. California, of course, being the largest state, or the largest, not the largest by land mass, but certainly by population in the country. So that was an enormous loss. And fortunately, Barbara Lowe Fisher and National Vaccine Information Center was integral with working with, I believe, somewhere like a half a dozen other states that attempted similar measures and failed because of her efforts. The problem is because this occurred in Disneyland and they just used the media to the max. It was never a more potent intervention to trash people who believe there was some concern or with the safety of vaccines. So they really decimated it, and they were successful. They manipulated and distorted the truth and were able to convince the large portion of the population this wasn't, or at least the legislators, and they couldn't have enough, they didn't have enough influence to overturn that decision.
Mm-hmm. And when you say it happened in Disneyland, you're talking about a measles?
There was a measles epidemic, purportedly in Disneyland.
A few cases, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I don't remember specifics, but if you examine it carefully, you can see it was just blown out of proportion. It was just a smokescreen, essentially. Mm-hmm.
So basically, with the Disneyland, we're looking at 100 to 200 cases, and only one had serious issues.
Yeah, that's my understanding of what happened. It was relatively minor, and I think that this one person wasn't even from the U.S. It might have been from a foreign visitor. So the challenge, though, is to, you know, they are going to use these strategies. Their intention is to use this for the greater good. Is their working philosophical premise, and that it's okay to have a few people die and suffer, and you know, because most people are going to be protected. And I guess if that were true, you could question the justification for that. I mean, it may be potentially justifiable, but the problem is it's not true, because it isn't for the greater good, and they don't have any screening systems in place to identify all the damaged individuals. And when you look at and carefully examine objectively the number of individuals who are damaged, it far exceeds any potential benefit that they're possibly imagining from receiving these vaccines.
Yeah.
And there are some terrible ones like hepatitis B vaccine and Gardasil vaccines that are just destroying so many people, girls and young children. It's devastating. And you mentioned the autism one. I don't like to focus there. Clearly, they're an issue. I've treated hundreds of children with autism, and in many cases, it was clear from my clinical assessment that vaccines were a trigger. But there's many other triggers, too. It's the diet. It's so crucial. It's the toxin exposures and emotional genetic influences. So it's very rare to have one single issue. It can be occasionally, but it's this whole combination. So the central point that you'd like to take home is that these vaccines are not without potential danger or damage. That's why they have the Vaccine Compensation Injury Act that was passed by Congress already, and it's very difficult to get this. But even being as difficult as it is, they've awarded over $3 billion in damage because they can't deny that these people were harmed. I mean, you know, it's illegal. It is absolutely illegal in this country for like the last 20 years to sue the makers of vaccines for any damage. They are insulated from liability. So that's why they have this federal program to compensate them, and it's a workaround. And so the reason I mentioned that is there's clearly a potential for harm. No question, no one will deny that. So as a parent, typically it's a parent evaluating this for their child, you need to make the responsible decision to carefully evaluate the evidence and look at the risk, look at the side effects, and see if the benefits warrant or justify that. Because you have to balance the scale for your child. Your child's too young. They can't do it for you. You have to do it for them. Mm-hmm. And if you do that and you carefully evaluate it, and you may reach a different conclusion than the public health authorities and your pediatrician is telling you. Mm-hmm. That's at least and sort of the conclusion I reached. Because after I came out of med school, I vaccinated thousands of children. And it's one of my biggest regrets in life that I did that. Because I didn't know any better, and I trusted them, blindly trusted them, that they were telling the truth. And many physicians were like me. They believe that they're being told the truth. They don't have the time, effort, or energy or resources to carefully examine it themselves. But if they did, they would reach the inevitably, if they were objective, rational, that they would think there's no other conclusion that you could reach that there's some serious potential problems here that have to be seriously examined, and you have to weigh the evidence. And in some cases, if you objectively you've done your due diligence and you reach conclusion you want to vaccinate, then it's fine. I think it should be a choice, but it shouldn't be forced on anyone.